Hello, I'm Kate Chabot. Welcome to an extra edition of the SITREP podcast. On May the 5th, 1980, millions of British people unexpectedly witnessed an historic event in a way they never had before. As the SAS stormed the Iranian embassy to end a six-day siege in which more than 20 people had been held hostage, all three channels broadcast the unfolding drama live. It was a revolutionary moment in television news, but it was also a revolutionary moment for the SAS. After years entirely in the shadows, it had carried out an operation in full public view. For many who were watching, this was the first they knew of the regiment's existence. It revealed their capability and a new role for the unit created in World War II. But those events have also become mythologized. Now, for the first time, the men of the SAS who planned and executed Operation Nimrod have been authorized to share their stories. They talked to historian Ben McIntyre for his new book, The Siege. He's been telling me about his definitive account of those events and his own memory of them.
I was watching the snooker, believe it or not, at that point. As many people were, 14 million people in Britain were watching the snooker final between Hurricane Higgins and Cliff Thorburn. And it had got to a very crucial moment when the footage cut away live to the SAS attacking this building in central London, in which six gunmen had been holed up for a week with 26 hostages. At the end of April 1980, at 11 o'clock in the morning, six heavily armed Arab gunmen broke in to the Iranian embassy in Kensington. They took over the building. Their aims were very specific, but not what most people think. They were demanding political rights for the Arab minority in Iran. This was just after the Iranian Revolution. The Arabs in Khuzestan, the oil-rich part of Iran, had contributed to the revolution, and they had expected to be recompensed with political rights. Now, that had not happened. The Ayatollah had clamped down brutally on the Arab insurgency, or what became an Arab insurgency. And these six gunmen had come to London to fight back, in a way. I mean, they were terrorists. They were also, in their own minds, as many terrorists are, freedom fighters. And what very few people know is that they were bankrolled by Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and they had been trained by the most wanted terrorist of the time, Abu Nidal. So it's a much more complicated story than many people realize. And for 6 days, Britain underwent an intense hostage drama. When these six gunmen stuck in there holding on to these hostages, a few were released. And the story is really one of sort of negotiation between the police and the gunmen over what to do, how to resolve this situation. So it involves not only political decision making from Margaret Thatcher at the top, but sort of individual decision making made by the police and negotiators and so on the ground. And it's a fascinating story, I think. It all takes place really in one room. I mean, the gunmen inside this room are holding these hostages. And by good fortune, I've been able to access a lot of the material that allows one to actually tell the minute-by-minute account of what really happened. But what most people know about is the dramatic denouement at the end when the SAS went in.
And Ben, I mean, this story, there are so many different accounts of it that have been told over the years. I'm just really interested to know why you wanted to write this book and what you wanted to add. What's different?
Well, I've long wanted to write this book. When I first wrote Rogue Heroes, my wartime account of the SAS, with SAS authorization, at that time I asked the SAS, would it be possible to write about this story, which meant such a lot to me as a young person. And they said at the time, not a hope, that's not going to happen. One of my reasons for wanting to write it is that this is one of the most heavily mythologized stories in British modern history. I mean, the old joke goes that if everybody who claimed to have been one of, you know, to have taken part in the assault on the Iranian embassy had actually been on that balcony on that day, the balcony would have fallen off. The reality is that actually what I wanted to do was to demythologize this story, to tell it in a way that wasn't just a story of sort of derring do, and it was turned into a kind of legend. Now, that was partly because Margaret Thatcher and her cabinet and her advisors realized that this was an enormous PR advantage. And they too added to the whole mythologizing, the making of a legend about this. So I wanted, without undermining the bravery and the participation of those involved, I wanted to try and tell a real, true, non-fiction account of what had really happened. Because I think the myths have not done a service in a way to this story. They've made it into a kind of simple story of heroes and villains, of goodies and baddies, of brave soldiers doing the right thing and wicked gunmen, you know, fighting back. It's actually much more complicated than that.
And just how many myths and inaccuracies did you encounter?
Beyond number, actually. I mean, beyond. I mean, this is a story that has accreted myths, and then the myths get told again as fact, and then the facts inform more myths. So I really had to sort of strip it down right to the beginning. And I could not have done that, and I can't emphasize this enough, I could not have done that without the cooperation of the Ministry of Defense. The Ministry of Defense gave formal approval for the surviving participants in this story, the SAS soldiers who had actually taken part, to talk openly for the first time. And that's not just the people who were actually on the balconies, who were actually going in through the basement and coming down through the central well and placing the explosives. It's also the people who planned it. One of them is a man called Hector Gullen, Major Hector Gullen, who was the officer commanding B Squadron, who was the person who drew up the assault plan. He was the maker of Operation Nimrod. He has never talked about his story before. So I was able to talk to the people who'd actually done it, you know, and actually consult the things that they wrote at the time, the plans that were laid out.
What was it like meeting them?
Rather moving, actually. I found this over the years. I mean, I've written a lot about spies and people for whom secrecy is an absolutely central tenet of their lives. It was rather moving. Some of these people had never, and I mean never, spoken about these events before. So 43 years of keeping, apart from with their own colleagues within the regiment, but they had never spoken to an outsider, let alone somebody who was going, like me, to write their account. And some found it extremely difficult. That, you know, they found it very hard to tell me the whole story. But as with all these things, once people get going and they get into their own stories, actually, I found it extraordinarily poignant. For many of them, this was an absolutely crucial turning point in their lives, which they'd really never been able to discuss outside of of a sort of small circle of colleagues.
And Ben, there is a startling revelation right at the start of your book. 41 minutes after the terrorists had burst into that embassy, the SAS was tipped off by a police officer. It seems they knew before the Home Office did.
They actually did know before the Home Office did. They knew because a former SAS soldier called Dusty Gray, who had served in the regiment for many years, who knew about the contingency planning. I mean, in a way, one has to go back an even earlier stage because since 1972, in secrecy, the SAS had been preparing and training and planning for a terrorist attack of not precisely of this sort, but of any sort. And that dates back to the Munich Olympic massacre when there was an appalling terrorist attack there. And the British government at the time decided there had to be provision made in case a similar thing happened on British soil. So Dusty Gray had been trained. He knew about what was called the Special Projects Team. But by this point, he'd become a dog handler for the police. And he just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And once the police signal had gone up, he knew about it. He was on the emergency radar and he picked up the telephone. Well, he went and did a kind of recce around the building. And then he picked up the telephone to Hereford, to Bradbury Lines, to the SAS headquarters and said, boss, he got through to Michael Rose, the Colonel Michael Rose, who was the commander of 22 SAS, and said, boss, something's happening down here. You need to get going. So Michael Rose had, in fact, authorized B Squadron of the SAS to get moving before he was informed by the police. That came about 20 minutes later.
It's incredible. And two SAS teams kitted up and came from Hereford to London that night, the Wednesday. What were they doing in the days that followed before the raid itself?
Well, first of all, they were held at Regent's Park Barracks in central London. And then they were moved in total secrecy in civilian clothing into the building next door to the Iranian embassy. So the Iranian embassy was at number 16 Prince's Gate, a huge Georgian townhouse, six different floors. Next to it, number 15, in fact, number 14 and 15, were the former US ambassador's residence, which had since become the Royal College of GPs, which was taken over by the military in complete secrecy. And the SAS teams came in through the back door on the first night of the assault, of the attack on the embassy, and were there for the duration, ready to go. The plans of what they were going to do evolved over time, but for the next 6 days, day and night, there were teams of heavily armed soldiers ready to go in.
And the raid itself, it didn't go entirely to plan, did it?
Plans, as anybody listening to this on your station will know, almost never go entirely to plan. Hector himself, Hector Gullen, is very funny about this. He says, for every plan that you make, the enemy is also making a plan. The reality was they had a pretty good intelligence idea of what was going on inside that embassy. MI5 and the police technicians had drilled eavesdropping devices into the walls and dropped them down the chimneys. So they had a pretty clear idea of who was where the hostages were being held, where the gunmen were, where, when the attack took place, the lead gunman, a man called Tawfiq al-Rashidi, they thought they knew where he would be because a field telephone had been brought into the building with a measured lead on it. So they knew roughly, if he was on the telephone, where he ought to be. Now, so that was the planning. Of course, it didn't quite work that way because Tawfiq al-Rashidi was no fool. He had moved the hostages around the building. They were not in the room where the SAS thought they were. Moreover, he himself, while he was on the field telephone at the time of the assault, and you could hear this happening, he was not in the place where they thought he was. He had actually moved the telephone up to the first floor. He was on the first floor landing. So one key element of the assault was that an explosive device lowered down into the central shaft of the building was going to destroy the glass atrium light that stood over the central hallway, a large structure of glass and metal. It was going to destroy this and drop it straight onto the lead gunman. That was the plan. And the theory was that he should be holding the telephone in the hallway. The truth is he wasn't. He was actually out of range. He was on the first floor landing. So when the bomb went off, several tons of glass and steel and timber and plaster came crashing down into the hallway where he wasn't. I'm not going to give away exactly what happened after that, but the reality is, like most military operations, this one depended on astonishing training, a willingness to adapt a plan to fit what was unexpected, and thirdly, an enormous dose of luck.
An enormous dose of not being lucky was that the incident, which famously was captured, one of the SAS soldiers getting tangled while abseiling down.
Absolutely. This was at the back of the building. Again, the officer you're referring to, Tommy Morell, has told his story for the first time. So we actually have a first-hand account of what was going on. This was the second team, if you like. They weren't quite numbered that way. But these were the people attacking the back of the embassy, and they were coming down on abseil lines to a balcony on the second floor where they believed the hostages were being held. They believed the hostages were being held in this back room. This first team of four abseilers was going to get to the balcony, throw explosives through the windows, liberate the hostages, it was by far the most difficult part of the operation. Two things intervened, if you like. One was the hostages were not held in that room. What's more, that room had been locked. They could get into that room, but they couldn't get out again. And the second was that Tom Morell, the leader of this group, Staff Sergeant Tom Morell, became entangled in his abseil wire as he was coming down, the belaying device, the figure of eight thing. No one knows quite what happened. But he was suspended. He was suspended in midair above the balcony. What's more, the other members of the team had already gone in. They had thrown explosives, flashbangs and CR gas canisters into the room. And one of the elements of a flashbang is it's not only a sort of stun device, it's an incendiary device. And the room was on fire. And the curtains caught fire very, very quickly. And Tom Morell was suspended above this fire, being burned slowly. He would have burned to death.
How did he talk to you about it?
Again, with some hesitation, he now lives in New Zealand. He's one of those extraordinary soldiers, Tom Morales, that he sort of downplays what happened, while at the same time his very understatement makes you realise quite how close it came to disaster. He was quite badly burned, Tom Morel. He had third-degree burns to his legs. But part of the problem was that he was above quite a narrow balcony. And while he could push himself away from the balcony, from the wall to try to get away from the flames, he was also then swinging back into the flames on the inward pull, if you like. And so his colleagues on the roof, who were waiting with a knife to try to cut the rope at the right moment, had to time the swing exactly so that he didn't either fall off the balcony 50 feet below or fall into the flames. So the timing of that cut, and they got it right. They got him down just as it was really taking hold of the building. He landed on the floor, stood up immediately, despite being quite badly injured at this point. Adrenaline is a very effective painkiller.
Yeah.
I don't think he realized quite how badly hurt he was. And he plunged back into the building and he led that assault team into the second floor. It was an astonishing act of bravery for which he was decorated.
Indeed. And ultimately, of course, the raid was successful. The hostages were freed, all but one who was killed in the crossfire during the raid.
It wasn't exactly crossfire. He was actually murdered by the second of the gunmen, who began opening fire on the hostages. I mean, in a way, it is one of the things that is often said, that somehow in the shootout, and it was pretty intensive inside that building, that there is a possibility that this hostage who died had somehow been killed by friendly fire. He wasn't. He wasn't executed exactly, but there was a terrible moment when the assault began, when the gunman simply opened fire. There's a particularly tough number two who did that. So it was a success. It was an astonishing success, really. I mean, even the people who participated in it are still rather amazed there weren't more casualties. There was only one SAS casualty who shot off the top of his finger by accident. That there were not more people gassed or killed. It is quite astonishing, actually. I mean, I've read the forensic reports, and while five of the six gunmen were killed, only one of the hostages had already been executed by the gunmen. There were only two fatalities. There were some extremely serious injuries among the hostages. But on balance, it was astonishing. I mean, it was hailed as an extraordinary victory. And one of the interesting things I think about that is that it became a kind of emblem of Margaret Thatcher's approach to terrorism. She had been in power for less than a year at this point. It was probably the most difficult decision she had to make. If it had gone the other way and the thing had ended in a bloodbath, as many believed it would, I mean, even the SAS believed that there would be 40% casualties during this assault. Had that happened, the story of modern British politics would be very different. I don't think she would have remained in. I think it would have, her grip on power would have been badly loosened. The SAS might have been disbanded. There are people in the SAS who believe that at this point the SAS was already under pressure. Might not have existed. It might have got, you know, it might have been absorbed elsewhere in the army. So in a way, the long-term significance of this story is both political and military. I mean, it really does change the landscape, and its very success does that.
And what do you think it did do for the SAS?
Again, this is rather a controversial argument. I mean, one of the things it did for the SAS was immediate, that it thrust them into the limelight. Most people had never heard of the SAS at this point. They were a shadowy part of the military. They were operating in Northern Ireland, but very not widely known about. When they were known about, pretty controversial. You know, these were tough days for the Troubles in Northern Ireland. So they suddenly overnight became celebrities. Applications to join the SAS rocketed overnight. I mean, Peter de la Billière, who was the director of Special Forces, is quite funny about this. He says that, you know, people were turning up at recruiting centres thinking they were simply going to be given a machine gun and allowed to go and mount their own assaults wherever they wanted to. You know, it led to an enormous increase in the number of people. The long-term effects of it you can still see today in this tradition, or it's not quite a tradition, in the mystique that surrounds the SAS of kind of daring do, who dares wins, you know, we go in, all those television programs about how tough how tough can you be? They're in a way the direct descendant of this story. But there are people who feel that it actually did not benefit the SAS in the long run. Michael Rose is one of them. Michael Rose will tell you that actually this made life for the SAS much more difficult because they could no longer operate in the shadows. They could no longer operate with total covert knowledge that they could do it in secrecy. And that made, in a way, their jobs much more difficult. They were now public figures, if you like. And in a way, it's something I think the SAS has wrestled with ever since, is the sort of balance between secrecy and maintaining secrecy and yet being public figures, if you like. So the difficulty is to how to mesh those two things together.
And perhaps key to its political and military significance is the fact that it was live on television as well. I mean, you mentioned that you saw it interrupting the snooker you were watching, unheard of in those days. How long did the whole thing last?
The assault, believe it or not, lasted 11 minutes. So that's roughly the time it takes to cook a hard-boiled egg. You know, I mean, it was over in a trice. And you have different battles taking place in different parts of the building simultaneously. So it's an astonishingly complex and very fast-moving operation. But you're absolutely right. We are now used, aren't we, to seeing live footage of television news. You know, everyone's got an iPhone, everyone's got a camera. We're actually used to sort of seeing what's happening in real time. Then it was completely unheard of. It broke into all three of the stations that existed at that point. I mean, you literally couldn't get away with it. For me, it was interesting. It was a very formative moment for me, actually, because I was very young. And I think it's one of the reasons that I became a journalist in the end. I sort of found the excitement of that moment almost unbelievable. I couldn't believe that something so kinetic, if you like, could be seen in real time. And so it was a turning point in terms of the media too. It really did change the way we see actuality unfolding in front of us.
And what surprised you the most in researching this book?
Can I have two answers to that? One is hugely surprised by, I mean, I had inherited, like everybody else, a belief that these terrorists were simple baddies. They'd gone in to cause mayhem, that they were killers. Actually, while they were men of violence, their story, each of them, is much more human than that. They also have their own stories. And unfolding those and teasing those out, while it will not be popular in some circles, and I by no means justify what they do, nonetheless, they, like everybody in the world, have their own story that has really never been told before. And I was astonished by just how interesting that story was. And the second element, I think, is probably the humility of the men who actually carried out the assault. I mean, because this story is associated with great daring do and people saying, well, I was on the balcony when it happened, it's sort of become a story of sort of bragging, really. I mean, that it's when Britain really showed how tough it was. What I was amazed by was that every single one of the SAS people I spoke to, every single one without exception, paid tribute to the other members of the team and sort of rather downplayed his own role in it. And I think that's astonishing, really. It's not what we associate with the sort of more public sort of showing off aspect of the SAS, which you see in the television programs and people who write the books and so on. The real people who carry these things out are astonishingly discreet and actually very modest about it.
So when you take a step back, was this the making of the SAS?
Well, I would say the SAS was made in the North African desert in during the war. I mean, that is when the whole ethos of what the SAS was going to be was developed by David Stirling and his band of rogue warriors operating there. So I would say that is when the SAS was made. This is when the SAS, if you like, was discovered. This was when the reality of what they actually did and do and continue to do became known to a wider public. And it was an astonishing achievement. And one measure of that is the way that foreign governments from this moment onwards, from 1983, began trying to borrow the SAS, began being trained by the SAS. So it really did give Britain a kind of military status and a military calling card that had really not existed before. So yes, this was in some ways the making of the modern SAS, but they had been in existence obviously since the war.
And just to take you back, I mean, you said that when you saw this happening live on television as that young person, that it really kind of was a moment for you, which made you the person that you are now. I'm just wondering, now that you've written the book, you've made your account in such detail, how you feel having put your pen down or stopped typing and having done it?
Well, it's a strange feeling, isn't it? Because, of course, history never quite ends. I mean, I'm sure mine will not be the definitive account. Others will come along. Other bits of the story will emerge. But I feel very proud, really, in a way, that I've been given the privilege to do this. I think it shows, I'm very touched that, in a way, that I've been allowed to have access to these people before they go, because, you know, some are on the, you know, they are many, most of them are in their 80s, some are older, some are frail. You know, these are old soldiers who have not really had the opportunity to tell their stories. And I think there is something very cathartic in that for them. And I've been just delighted to be able to do that. And it's not really just the soldiers. I mean, this is also a story about the police. It's a story about the surviving hostages. It's a story that is within living memory. So it's a story, in a way, also about one particular policeman, Trevor Locke, who was the policeman guarding the front of the embassy, who was bundled inside and injured during the attack on the embassy, who kept his gun with him throughout. So there are other stories that are being given, I hope, a kind of new life before the real lives end.
Ben McIntyre, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Kate.
News, discussions, and analysis. This is SITREP.